My name is Monty Akers. I was 16 when this occurred, but my involvement is as a writer, and we have a book, my son and I, with the assistance of a friend of one of the victims, as well as a licensed psychologist named Roger Friedman, Dr. Roger Friedman, have written a book that will be released within probably a month or so about the incident. And it is written specifically because the 50th anniversary is on the horizon. There are lesser myths and misinterpretations, such as the concept that Whitman targeted certain people, particularly his first victim, on purpose, or that he intentionally shot a pregnant woman, or that he took multiple weapons to the top of the tower in order to make people believe that there were multiple shooters. Those are understandable interpretations, but they proved to not be correct. And in many ways, the proving of those last two or three misinterpretations stemmed from our analysis of a small piece of adhesive tape that Whitman put on the butt of the 6mm Remington scoped rifle that he used for most of his shooting. And that the three numbers on that piece of tape proved to open up new vistas and understanding of what he did, why he did it, in the sense of who he shot and why he was aiming at them, that was new information that hadn't been explored before. He wrote three numbers on that piece of tape that were his own directions for how to aim his rifle, assuming he was aiming in a particular manner at a particular target or a particular area. And it took the efforts of a expert on firearms, an expert on shooting, with the assistance of a former Army sniper, to over about 2-3 days of head scratching to figure out exactly what those three numbers meant. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was like 16, negative 83, and 6.4, numbers like that. And that piece of tape is still on the rifle in the Crime Museum, where it's on display in Washington, D.C. And I contacted the museum, and they dutifully went to the display and read off the numbers. It took a while to be certain we had the right numbers and what they meant. She happened to be at the very spot on the South Mall that he had possibly stepped off as the ideal target. And Whitman was an expert. He was a gun nut, to use the term loosely. Shooting was a very early hobby, avocation, joy of his. Certainly it was something taught to him by his father. And then he was a good marksman when he was in the Marine Corps. And he fantasized about going up on top of the tower and shooting people, and repeated that fantasy at least 4 times that we know of, and probably more, and told more than just his roommate. And when one fires from high elevation, it is different from just putting your crosshairs on a target and pulling the trigger. So firing from that extreme 307-foot elevation meant that he had to make certain adjustments on his telescopic sight. And that led to what those numbers meant and where he was intending to fire and who literally ambled into his gun sights and became his first and second targets, as well as some thereafter. They, if you look at the photographs, or the some of which are in the book, and most of which come from newsreel footage of the time, you'll see that at one time there were five or six, at least, bodies lying in that same general area. One of them was Rita Jones, who was not wounded, who was one of the heroes or heroines of the day, because she ran out and lay down beside Claire Wilson and stayed there with her. So when you look at the photographs, you may get the impression that there's more bodies than there really were. But yes, that particular scene, that particular tableau was the epicenter of the victimization that occurred as a result of his shooting, aiming and shooting at exactly what he had planned to aim and shoot at. The South Mall was the obvious, easy target. It was directly below him, from the south side of the clock tower, or walkway, and the numbers would apply equally on the other three sides, in the sense of where to put your crosshairs on a target, but. The fact that most of the victims, the initial victims and multiple victims, did go down in that same general area on the south side makes me feel pretty confident that that's what he was calibrating his numbers on. And as an aside, I asked someone who knew him if to his knowledge, he ever practiced shooting from high elevations, and the response was, well, he probably went out to Mansfield Dam and shot rock squirrels. And Mansfield Dam's higher than the tower when you measure to the area where the colony of rock squirrels lives. And then I called a longtime employee of LCRA who confirmed that, yeah, back in those days, people would go out and shoot rock squirrels from Mansfield Dam. That was, you know, there was no 620 running where it is now. So that was probably how he, or might have been how he, zeroed in on those numbers. Charles Whitman was a complicated individual, or he was made complicated by his father, who was abusive in both physical and emotional and verbal ways. He was burdened with a concept of what it meant to become a success, primarily by his father and by his own efforts, and was unable to live up to his own expectations. And he suffered from, had certain psychological or emotional disorders, and that's where Dr. Friedman was very helpful. And then there was a catalytic event. The shootings were on a Monday, and on either Friday evening or Saturday morning before that, something happened that tipped him over the edge. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And in retrospect, it was a significant event in anybody's life, but it shouldn't have been a life-changing event. And yet we concluded, and of course it's all supposition, but supposition with support. One of his own uncles, his mother's brother, said that is what caused him to do it. So we believe we can tell you at least what that tipping point was. It doesn't explain why he would kill his wife, whom he loved, his mother, whom he adored. The effect of his, it's rather interesting that as abusive as his father was, and to both him, his two brothers, and particularly their mother, Margaret, that the separation and pending divorce of his parents affected him as deeply as it did. It, of course, March 29th is the day that he visited the one psychologist or analyst who, to whom he repeated the Climb the Tower story. And it was that interview and that doctor's notes on the interview that are probably as revealing as anything other than the two letters that he wrote, one after he killed his mother and the other preceding and following his murder of his wife, that give us insight into why what type of thoughts were in his head. But he wasn't completely honest. He to some degree was either unable or unwilling to deal with his own problems totally and honestly. And his reasons for killing his mother and wife just don't make sense. I mean, the idea that he didn't want them to suffer the embarrassment for what he already planned to do, at least in my mind, does not justify by any stretch of the imagination what he did. His letters, the two letters he wrote early on August 1st, after killing his wife and mother, make it clear that his hatred for his father was at the top of his mind, and that he wanted the world to blame his father, and some people did, and C.A. Whitman had to live with that. But to some degree, I think C.A. Whitman took some small degree of pride in what a good marksman his son turned out to be, and it certainly didn't cause him to reform in any way. Paul was a young graduate of Austin High School who was the grandson of a speechwriter for LBJ, and Paul Bolton was his name, as well as the director for for Austin's only television station at the time, and was a man that was almost synonymous in the minds of Austinites of 1966 with the media and news coverage and so forth, and one of the rather tragic sidelights of the killings was that as the shootings were still occurring, one of the newscasters named Joe Roddy did something unusual, which was to read the names of victims who had been killed on the air, and they were doing that without having notified the next of kin yet, in order to assuage the fears of people who were calling in that were terrified that their loved ones were victims. So he read the latest list of victims, one of whom was Paul Sontag, and Paul Bolton was listening and said, "Hold it there, Joe, back up and read those names again. I think you just named my grandson," which he had done. And as it turned out in our research, we wound up talking to two close friends of Paul Sontag, one of whom was there, went to his body on August 1st, 1966, hoping to help, saw that there was nothing he could do, and then quickly ducked behind a car because shots were being fired at him, without knowing it was his good friend Paul. And then two more men who were either there right before or right after that gentleman, who wound up trying to help him, picking him up and putting him in an ambulance. And Paul is just a good-looking guy, and people who knew him talked about what a natural leader he was. Well, the whole story of what happened to Whitman's body after the shootings is well, it's a chapter of the book. And yes, there were people. Well, we talked to a coroner. We talked to an undertaker who said he saw the tumor. We had, in our research, found references to what Dr. Coleman Deschenar, who was the coroner who performed the autopsy, identified as the tumor, and at least one other surgeon's comment that he did not see it. I mean, he looked at it, but didn't regard it as a tumor. We talked to two members of the Connolly Commission, and that's a commission of 32 experts, most of them medical, who were appointed by Governor John Connolly to investigate the incident and make recommendations. And, of course, after 50 years, there's not a whole lot of them still around, but we did manage to locate two of the younger members who are still living. And in both cases, they just kind of dismissed the idea that the tumor was a cause of it. But they also, one of them also admitted that that was a topic of hot debate on the commission. I think the debate was primarily over if there was a tumor, would it have caused it? And then as a sidebar comment was, the sidebar comment was, I'm not even sure there was a tumor. So, you know, the tumor was, you know, when it was revealed, it was almost a relief for everyone. Ah, there's, that explains it. Now we can go to bed easy. We understand why that happened. Although Dr. Deschenar described it as an interesting find and nothing more. And he completed his autopsy and went back home and was then told, and then commented that he had found this tumor and was ordered to go back and get samples of it. He came back after the body was embalmed before it was autopsied, which was an odd occurrence. Then it was autopsied, and then it was closed and re-embalmed and put in clothing and in a casket and in a shipping crate to be shipped by railroad to Florida. And then Dr. Deschenar came back the next day and said, we got to do it again. And they had to open him up again, and so he could get samples. The undertaker that was present at the second, who was present when the day, he was present at the autopsy, and he was present the next day when Dr. Deschenar came back to get the samples. His description was that on that second visit, the purpose was to get samples. And there's some other reports in the files that support that. And yet the surgeon that I mentioned, who kind of dismissed what he saw as being a tumor, I think he described it as looking like looking like peanut butter, apparently visited Dr. Deschenar immediately after the initial autopsy. So he must have taken some samples and then gone back for more. A article that was published in the I can't remember the publication. It'll come to me. Very well-known historical publication. That from a lieutenant who was writing essentially about Whitman's court-martial. Whitman, after he had a Marine Corps or a Naval scholarship that brought him to UT in the first place, and he then failed to keep his grades up and to otherwise conduct himself as a Marine officer, which was what the goal of the program was. And so his scholarship was terminated, and he went back to Camp Lejeune as an enlisted man, and was thereafter court-martialed for various offenses, including having an unauthorized firearm, having ammunition on base, charging usurious interest rates to fellow Marines, loaning them money, threatening one of them that didn't repay him promptly. And he was given confinement in the brig for a while as a result. And it was during that time that he kept a journal. And this particular Marine Corps officer, a lieutenant, knew him. And the point of his article was he was confounded as to why Whitman was court-martialed, that in his opinion he was almost a model soldier, which he had certainly been in his first service in the Marine Corps. And this officer could not understand why he was selected for trial and punishment for doing things that the Marine Corps turned a blind eye to on a regular basis. And he speculated or hinted that perhaps it was because Whitman's father, C.A. Whitman, was lobbying hard with the Naval Department and with his, I believe, congressional representative to get his son released from the Marine Corps, and that the intent may have been to demonstrate that, no, this soldier is not deserving of any kind of special treatment. As far as being wild, he was not a drinker, contrary to some reports about him having bathtubs full of beer and ice and getting drunk occasionally. That apparently was not the case. Spoken to at least two people who knew him said that he didn't really drink at all. I mean, didn't like the taste of it. But when he got to UT for the first time, it was his first taste of real freedom. No longer under the thumb of his father nor the strict discipline of the Marine Corps. And he lived on the edge. He loved to drive extremely fast. He would do risky things like dangle from the balcony of his dorm so that Kathy could see him driving through the streets of Austin at night at over 100 miles an hour on a motorcycle. And there's the incident where he was caught after having shot a deer out of season and brought it back to his dormitory to butcher in the dormitory stalls or shower stalls. Although that particular incident has probably been kind of over-exaggerated. But yeah, he kind of lived life on the edge. He enjoyed himself, and if you go through the interview notes from both the Austin Police Department and the FBI and the DPS, it's amazing how many people talk about him being the last person they would have ever expected to do this, and how he was always so friendly and upbeat and carefree and laughing and joking. They just couldn't imagine that he would have been the person to do this. So he was a Jekyll and a Hyde.